anyway.
Oh, wait, do you know where we are over Easter?
Yeah.
We are. In the room.
In the deep imaginary.
In the deep, in the very deep blue.
In the very hot deep imaginary.
Enjoy it on Friday and Monday.
Okay, let's have a little look just before lunch. Perhaps if we go on till 12:45, is that okay? Can we do that? Just to sort of have half an hour just to set the scene. Because I do want to use this weekend a bit to consolidate and get a sense of where we are. And so I'm going to start just at the beginning again, really. Because what are we doing here? What is this, you know, where in a way that this discourse comes out of two Welsh words, the one word being anu na anuvin and the other being the word an awen, with similar sounding. And the reason I chose those words and made them the basis of really of my work is because they just hold a lot for me, really, because about all kinds of parts of my life, all kinds of my work, in different arenas. Because the word, and they both hold in a certain way a feeling of paradox in them. Because the word anun or anuvin in Welsh means the very deep place. It also means the place that is not a place. The word awen, its common meaning would be inspiration. And a bard or a poet would said to be possessed by the awen, or they would be called the awenydd, the men or women who are in the service of inspiration. It's an image a bit like the muse that you have in English. But the word, more deeply, means, the word wen in Welsh means white or holy. The letter R before it is a word, is a letter that means negation. So you could say it is the not holy inspiration, or the whiteness that is not white. And it's described in the very early bardic literature. Inspiration is sometimes described as being like water and like fire. So both these words are a bit strange, if we pay attention to them, because it talks about going into a place that's not a place, but is very deep. Right? So. At the heart of what we're looking at here, that we're talking about paradox, right? So what are you doing here? Oh, we're going into Annan. Where's Annan? Oh, well, it's very deep. Yeah, and? No, it's very deep. And, well, that's very deep. We're going into somewhere very deep that's hard to put into words. And we're going into somewhere that is a place that is a not place. That's the heading. And in a certain way, these phrases and some of these stories and poems are designed to do our heads in. Because they're designed to take us away from our linear way of looking at things. And to take us underneath our normal sense of ourself and our normal sense of the world. Now, what happens to that all the time is constantly we because we are beings who need to make sense of the world, right? So that there's nothing wrong with making sense of the world, provided that sense has got the room in it for newness, for difference, for change. But one of the problems that happens, particularly as we get older, we develop these habitual ways of thinking and feeling and being and experiencing that close us off to both awen and anuvin. So we tend to live more in the known places and don't have so much space for the unknown. Now, what the bards would say, and I guess what I would say as well, and what Jung would probably say as well if he was here, is that those places, that underneath place, that deep place is there all the time. That inspiration possibility is there all the time. Lots of times we touch it, but staying with it and letting it change the structures that we build up in ourselves and in our life is actually quite difficult. And normally frightens and disturbs us when that's happening. So feelings that are being out of control or being, I don't know myself, am I being cruel to people? Am I, what happens if I do speak up for myself? What happens if I behave differently? All these are the sort of things that happen when we touch some of this deeper, more dynamic place in ourselves. That actually does start to cause change. Now, what's great hearing you talk about how things are for you is everybody's stirred up in different ways. And that's from my point of view, that's good. I mean, it's not easy, I know, but actually, in a way, part of what this training is intended to do is to stir us up, is to disarrange our normal ways of knowing and being, and to connect us to something that is deeper in ourselves, that is connected with our own energy, our own life energy, our own creativity, our own particular take on the world. And the point of the group, the point of the process is to help that come into our lives in a way that can cause positive change. And that's really important. Now, it's difficult to do that. It's not difficult to feel it. It's not even difficult to experience it. It's really hard to stay with it. And one of the particular problems we have in our society is we don't have tools that encourage us to do that. I mean, partly the reason why we're looking at old Welsh traditions and the Tree of Life and things like that is because these come from times and traditions where people knew how to do that, and therefore there are tools that exist in those places that can help us to stay with the process. But the point of the work is not to become anything other than yourself. The problem with any tool is, so if we look at Welsh tradition or we look at the Kabbalah, it's people become Kabbalists or become Welsh. And that isn't the point. Because then you just create a different identity, which, you know, that can be fun. It can be fun to play with identities. But the point of this work isn't to become a Welsh bard or become a Kabbalist or become Jung or Jungian. It's to connect with the deep place inside you and to trust that. To trust your own connection to the deep, whatever that means for you. And to let, if you like, the movement, the process, the awen that arises from the deep come into expression in your lives. So when we do the awen chant together at the beginning of the morning, the what we're doing is an interesting thing there, because we're expressing this sound that represents this the energy arising out of the deep. And how we do it is we all do it in our own way, and together the sounds that get woven are really very beautiful. But it depends on us. In order to do that chant, you have to let it come out of you, and you have to trust where it goes without knowing where it's going to go. You have to just stay connected with it. If you start thinking, well, perhaps I should now do it high or should do it low, you stop chanting. You get disarranged. So in a way, that little chant, in some ways, holds the whole process that we're doing. You feel connected to it. You bring it out. We're in relationship with each other. So we're not just doing this on our own. We're coming into relationship, letting our sound affect other people's sound, and their sound affects our sound, not subliminally. We're not doing this as a conscious thing, but we're doing this, creating a sound picture, if you like, that keeps developing. And in a way, that's what we're doing in this in this kind of wider kind of work. This place where the fundamental movement is to get present with yourself, and then go in and down, and explore what we find through any of our senses. So sometimes what we find is very visual. Or sometimes it can be we can just hear sound. Sometimes it's just textures, or you feel like you're touching things or being touched by things. Sometimes it can be tastes, or sometimes it can be just a feeling of overall knowing, a kind of a felt sense of being, you know, you could have a felt sense perhaps of being in the wood, or being in the mound, or encountering something. And but what happens is we start to engage with this. I'll talk more technically about some of the details later in the weekend, but going over the poem and the tree a bit more, but what happens is we start to engage with a living process that has its own meaning. And unexpected things happen. So for example, Lou finds herself, finds the wood and the mound outside, and the spiral path outside herself in Sardinia. Now this is this idea that Jung had of synchronicity, of the inner and the out and the outer coinciding together. And if we can let, you know, synchronicities like this happen happen all the time, and are really kind of mysterious. So there's something that if we can really let that in and let the power and the precision. Think about synchronicity; it's always really precise, right? So when we notice it, when we're affected by it, it's really precise. So we, you know, we encounter actually, you know, Lou encounters a spiral path and a wood and a mound, you know. It's extraordinary, and it's in Sardinia, and kind of, and who knew, you know? You know, it's all like, I knew about, you know, and people affect each other, right? So, Ali and I are trying to work out where to go on holiday, because nothing's normally working. We think Lou's mentioned Sardinia, You put some stuff on your Facebook page, and so I look at Lou's Sardinia picture, and it looks really nice. And then we look at, and then suddenly we're going to Sardinia as well, right? So I don't, you know, but that's the mysterious process, right? Happening, you know. So Fern and I talk about Wales, talk about Greg Cavanbarg, the only person, Fern is the only person in my life that I've ever met outside Wales who knows Greg Cavanbarg. And in October, I'm doing a workshop in Greycavern Park in the village. Now, who knew, right? How did that happen? Now, none of this is planned, but there is what happens in my experience is, as we trust these deep places, strange, mysterious connections happen. And you find yourself doing things and experiencing things and being a certain way, in a way that you could never have predicted. And one of the other key things is this image here that which I like to use a lot, and why I've given, you know, gave you all a copy of that to keep. Is it a lot? I like this image very much because you have this black and white, and it sort of flips back and forth, this image. But it's also got this image of you go around in spirals, and then there's this straight line that cuts down the middle. And the thing about this mysterious process is it's often like that. You can feel like you're wandering around in circles, and then something happens, some insight happens, some shift happens, and suddenly you move all the way through something. And in a way this image again holds the whole process that we're following. And in a way, you know, the poem Prithayanun, this image and that schematic diagram of the Tree of Life, these are the basic tools, really. And as the course goes on, we can explore that and already have explored other stories, other songs, other things. But these are the kind of bases, things we'll keep on coming back to. And coming back to them because they hold this kind of deep intention of connecting to Anuvin, connecting to the deep, and trusting the movement of the Awen that comes out when you do that. Trusting that not just internally but externally. Trusting it both in what happens to us inside and what happens and the products that come out of that, but also trusting it in our relationships. And the thing, the mysterious thing that keeps on happening is, it comes out this really little. I mean, underneath the table, I've got this little image of the goddess Brigid with a snake that spirals around her. I was working with my clients last week, and I've been working with this woman 15 years, and so she's been in this room as long as I've been in this room, and that sat there underneath there, and she's been doing a lot of work for about the last 2 years about working with this totem snake that comes to her, and. And so she does a lot of work with the snake. We've done a lot of work with the snake. She sits pretty much where Fern's sitting, and I sit here just over there. And she says, "Oh my God, there's a snake under the table on Tuesday." And it looked to her, just because of where she was looking, it looked like an act. And for that moment, it was an actual snake. So actually, in that moment, she moves into a different space. There is her snake, the snake, the reality of it is that the snake is under the table, in the room with us, physically. And of course that shifts, and then I bring it out and she looks at it, and it's the whole thing. But that could have happened any time, right? So actually there was a very particular reason, which I won't go into, about why she saw the snake at that moment. But that was the moment. And that moment of synchronicity, that's the thing about synchronicity. I mean, people talk a lot about this in here, this town. But synchronicities are always very precise, and they disarrange your universe. They take things away from just being a private internal process to they become physical and real and solid. And they do something to your view of yourself and the universe when that happens. And so one of the things that happens when we do a course like this together, which is different, it's different to the one-off workshops I do, where we do a little process of 2 days and sort of come to a conclusion and great, then we stop. When we're in a continuous process like this, we're held in a larger intention. Now the intention of these 2 years, of these is that we really follow and sustain a process. Why I wanted to do the 2 years rather than keep doing the one-off workshops is because the intention of this is we keep connecting to that mysterious process, using whatever tools help us to do that. But we stay with it, right? The intention is we stay with it. It's often very confusing, and you wonder, why am I doing this? And why is he going on about that? And I sometimes wonder, why am I going on about that? Because I also, of course, I'm cooperating with this kind of deeper process, and I have, I have not a concrete. Well, I do. It is a plan. There is a process around these 2 years, but this is the third group, and it's completely different every time so far. Because, of course, the same elements are there. We look at the poem. We look at the tree. But actually, the what needs to happen each time is always different. Because the deeper things that we're doing, it's my job to help you trust that deeper process in yourself, trust your own relationship to Anavin, and trust the particular energy of Awen that is happening for you, and to encourage you to trust and follow that. Now, the stories of the Awanydd, the people of the Awen in Wales, they're described like mad people. There's a guy called Gerald of Wales who wrote a history of Wales, or a journey through Wales, Gerald's journey through Wales, and he describes these people frothing at the mouth or doing weird things or behaving in strange ways. And Gerald of Wales well, he was Welsh, but he identified with the Norman overlords of Wales, and he's writing for the Norman overlords. He's doing that thing where people are trying to plead. Aren't the peasants stupid and funny? So he's obviously not a very sympathetic writer. But what's interesting in his medieval description of the Iwenydd is that they are strange people because they're operating from a different framework. And his way of describing them is he camps it up a bit and sort of does a caricature of them, like how crazy the funny peasants are, my lord, not like us Normans. And he's a churchman as well, so he's very much distancing himself from that kind of bardic kind of tradition. And the other thing that's sort of interesting about bardic tradition is when the stories about the Mabinogion, the Book of Taliesin, the various things that we're looking at, they're coming out of a reinvention of tradition, of actually a profoundly creative act at a time when there's ancient tradition, ancient ways of working with the imagination, working with relationship with the land and physicality, and is massively under threat because the medieval world, you know, this is the world of the church, of the medieval church, where, and a world that we can't really appreciate now, but this is a totalitarian world. And a world that completely colonizes people's imaginations because the church is a power in the land. You have to go to church. You don't have an option. You know, get into a tremendous struggle. And they were talking, and this is before the Protestant Revolution, before nonconformism. This is the church in its full medieval power. This is the world that they're addressing. And what they do is they who knows who did this, but whoever created the Mabinogion, whoever put the poems of Taliesin together, worked with the world that they were working with, worked with the crystal. You have a lot of Christian imagery interspersed in the poems, not always just as a color. Sometimes that's a protective coloration because they have to make it look like it's not heretical. But what they also do is they incorporate and work with those images. They work with the imaginal world of the world around them. And one of the sad businesses is when people study Welsh things or Celtic things these days, they turn themselves into fantasy Celts. You know, so you get this fantasy. Wouldn't it be great if we could live like they were in the old days? Like the old Celts used to live. Now, if we really did want to live like the old Celts used to live, we should take up the practice of headhunting. What your old tribal Celt most liked to do is get buried up, so that some of the old traditions still carry on. Get buried up on a Saturday night, go off and steal somebody's cattle, and then take a few heads to put on your ancestral altar. And those are the bits of Celtic tradition that people aren't so keen to revive, generally speaking. You know, so we like to. It would have been horrible, right? It would have been bloody horrible. No, they definitely would have been hot chocolate. There'd been sort of, you know, the beer would have bits floating in it, right? So, there's all kinds of stuff that we would. But there's a sort of fantasy cult thing that people do, and actually it's always a bit difficult studying or talking about these things because people think that's what you mean. There's actually what's genuinely interesting in the work of the bard isn't any of that. It is interesting. It is something you're sort of drawing on these ancient, powerful, archetypal traditions, right? But you have to do it in the way that the bards did. It was to bring it into relationship with you here and now and the world around you. So if we're looking at that now, we have to incorporate massively the world of advertising, the world of commercial culture. So we have to look at, if we look at where does the imaginal manifest now, mostly on telly. You know, so there's one of the things I always get in trouble with the people is sort of, I think it's very good for us to watch telly. People say, don't watch telly. It'll contaminate you. Well, yeah, if you get obsessed by it and you don't do anything else, for sure. But actually, when you watch telly, when you go to films and things, you hear the collective imagination at work. And some of it's awful, right? But actually, it's crucial to connect yourself and your imagination with the world that you live in. And if you do that, what happens is this, an alchemy starts to happen where these ancient things, you start to create your own relationship. At this point, we're still early on in the process, so these poems I fling at you or these stories I tell you will feel alien. They're not quite internalized just yet, because you need to find your own way with them, with whatever bits speak to you. But what happens as they start to internalize is they start to energize and connect you and give you confidence in your own inner world. And then as your inner world meets that outer world, what starts to happen is the same kind of alchemy that would happen with the bards. That you start to, instead of being overwhelmed by the outside world or disconnecting from that world of imagination, a kind of a synergy starts to happen where those two inner, where the inner world and the outer world start to talk together in new and unusual ways. Now what we see happening with the people who wrote the Mabinogion is a whole new mythology arises that is much more human. The old Celtic gods were very tribal and very kind of, you know, the gods of one tribe were not the gods of another tribe. But you start to see these figures, that the figures that happen that come up in the Mabinogion, and the figure of Arthur, who's the central figure in all these traditions, is both a kind of more than human figure and a very human figure. And so you start to see a kind of development, a kind of where the gods or the deeper energies aren't driving us from outside. They become more humanized. There's more contact between us and them. And in particular, we get this central image of the bard Taliesin, who's the writer of the poem Prithianun, who is almost the archetype of this new way. And Taliesin is all about working with opposites, working with confusion. And he starts off as this figure, Little Gwion. So, and Little Gwion, all we know about Little Gwion in the beginning of the story of Taliesin, is he's there to stir the pot. The pot of the goddess Caridwen. And now Caridwen herself, who is a new goddess, because you don't find her in ancient Gaulish or Welsh tradition or Irish tradition. They create a new goddess. She appears, if you like, out of the collective. And Caridwen is again both is this very massive archetypal being who's also very human, because her story begins. She begins in this place called Pen y Llyn, the lake that is before all, the origin of lakes. She lives in the lake that is before all other lakes. So she is this ancient ancestral archetypal figure. But she's also a mother who's worried about her son. The whole story is she gives birth, and the whole beautiful, powerful thing about this is that she gives birth to Mavran, Avagdi. Her beloved child, who is ugly, who is painful, and she wants to help him. So the very story begins not in a place of perfection. It begins in a place, in an ancient place, where things have gone wrong, and she wants to help her child, so that his inner beauty can be seen. So we're with this image right at the beginning of this story, of something, of a being who looks terrible, who looks frightening, but she wants the world to see his inner beauty. So she brews this brew which will give him the gift of the Awen. Because the brew that she does, we've got poor old Avagdi sitting in his hut because everybody's scared and runs away from him. We have this great cauldron by Pen y Llyn, by the lake that is before all lakes, or probably really in the middle of the lake. And we have Little Gwion, who is this tiny, all we know about Gwion is that he's little, he's this tiny point of disturbance that keeps stirring everything around. Until the mysterious moment comes where the cauldron, the potion comes to fruition, comes to the boil. And three drops fly up into the air, and by accident, Gwion takes them into his mouth, sucks them into himself. Now, in a way, that's kind of, the whole course is like this. we have our internal cauldron, we create a cauldron together, and in whatever we're doing, because what she does is to bring things into the cauldron, pops them in so they come down. Now what I do here is I from my stories, from my learning, my Welsh stuff, I chuck things into the cauldron. And then the part of you that is little Gwion, which is, will work with whatever. So the whole cauldron, whatever's in the cauldron. But there is some place inside you all that is doing that turning. And it's a lovely image. You've got him stirring it. We've got the straight and the cauldron and the spiral. Right, because that's kind of what we're doing. We're stirring the cauldron, stirring the pot, keeping it going, keeping it on the boil. Not letting it boil over quite yet, but just staying with it. And in a sense, what happens is, I won't go into the whole story, I just need to go for lunch, but that's kind of where we are right now. Okay, we're sitting in the middle, stirring the cauldron, bringing things in, letting them kind of find their way. And as we start to do that, but of course nothing is linear, right? So we could be saying, oh, we'll just sit here and then eventually something will happen. All this happens simultaneously. The whole story happens simultaneously. So simultaneously as we're doing that, so we want to talk a lot about time this weekend. Time's very strange in the Mabinogion. Because even as we're doing that, as we're at that place, of course what's happening is the cauldron is boiling and insight is coming into you, inspiration is coming into you, and that goes out and changes the world. Now what, there's all kinds of things happen to tell Tessin later. One of the things that happens later is he goes down into prison and frees people. So simultaneously what happens as we sit with this stuff, even as we're sitting with the cauldron and being with this mysterious, not even really sure what we're doing, what we find happening is things get liberated. New parts of ourselves start to emerge. Different experiences start to happen. The whole story is happening simultaneously. But we have to process this more linearly because actually it gets a bit overwhelming. So in part, having gone through the first four workshops, are we? October, November, December, January, February. No, five. I've done five. Is that right? October, November, December. See, I'm really not linear. October, November, December, January, February, five. So this is our sixth workshop, and then right. So this is, we've done five workshops of this first year. So we've got another four left. So as we sit here, we're consolidating in some ways the experience of the first five workshops. But also, because everything is non-linear, we're really dealing with the whole thing all the time. So even as we consolidate, we move on. But it can help us this weekend, I think, if we consolidate and get a sense of the, if we just step out a bit, and there'll be opportunities for you just to talk together with each other about where you are in this, to get a sense, but it's important at this point for me just to give you a sense of that meta process. And it is all just held somewhere in these two words, Anuven, Owen. But it is doing the real work, and what we're doing is the real work those bards did, not a fantasy, Celtic, anything. Right, it's about the work we do here and now. In the end, we're looking at your cauldron and the potion that you're brewing for yourselves, which we're all part of course. And everybody's own journey is part of that. Whatever happens to Nicholas next, I don't know. I might come across him again, but I don't know. But he's been part of our journey. And in some ways, he travels with us because he's, we've been with him for, he wasn't here last time, so we've been with him four weekends, and he's not doing 30, he's not doing 18 weekends, he's just done four. So, but he's somewhere part of this, part of the brew. It's touched our lives in some ways. That'll fade a bit over time, it'll change, but right now, the absence of Nicholas is part of the brew. The key thing above all is to keep coming back into yourself, into your own sense of the mystery, into descending into Anavan and trusting the particular flow of Awen that arises for you. And to keep trying to trust that, which involves really trusting not knowing as well as knowing. To knowing is important, so to know that we're supposed to be doing that, right? To know that actually what we do is to keep going into Anavan and keep trusting the flow of Awen. That's important to know. But because that knowing immediately takes us into not knowing. Because if you go into Anavan, you go into the very deep place that is not a place. And if you cooperate with Awen, you cooperate with something that is mysterious, that's sometimes like fire, sometimes like water, can't be pinned down, but is somehow tangible. And it can sometimes make you look like a mad person to somebody like Gerald of Wales. And maybe that's a good thing. Let's stop and have lunch. And come back to this.